Welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Later in today's show, Prairie Public's movie reviewer extraordinaire Matt Olien dives into The Brutalist. It's a sweeping period drama directed by Brady Corbett, and the film follows the journey of a Hungarian-born Jewish architect as he immigrates to the United States after World War II and grapples with the monumental task of rebuilding both his life and career. Also, our weekly news review with our news director, Dave Thompson. He'll break down the week's headlines, including highlights from the opening week of the North Dakota legislature, including Governor Kelly Armstrong's State of the State address. And we begin Main Street today with our friend Eric Dragney. He's been on Main Street before. Eric, welcome back to Main Street.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Your book that we're going to visit about today is called Vikings in the Attic. It's an engaging exploration of the Nordic immigrant experience in America with a particular focus on the Midwest. Eric will be at the Troll Lounge in the Sons of Norway in Fargo, 1 o'clock tomorrow for a free reading. Eric, I bet you're really looking forward to that.
I love coming to the Troll Lounge. It's always it's a treat when back up to Fargo.
I told you earlier off mic that I feel that I should be conducting this interview with me on the back of my Honda Ruckus and you on the back of your Vespa. And we should have just met in a park somewhere and had a chat, because you've written about Vespas and those have been a part of your life, really, quite frankly, before.
Yeah, no, that's one of my passions, especially the Lambretta scooters, which are from Milan, where I lived for a while.
All right, let's talk about this book, Eric, if we could. Tell me, what inspired you to explore this topic of Nordic America identity, I guess, in such depth?
It began, my wife and I, we lived over in Trondheim, Norway for a year on a Fulbright fellowship where our first son was born. And when we came back to Minnesota and kind of realizing, okay, what is left? What is that Scandinavian Norwegian culture that we have here in the Midwest? Like, what has survived? What has changed since back over in Norway, and what have we held on to here in the Midwest? It began, so I wrote about living over in Norway in In God We Trust, but then this one was sort of a follow-up thinking, okay, what is that experience here? What does it mean to be Norwegian, Swedish, Danish, Finnish here in the Midwest? And so kind of delving into all the stories from my grandparents that they didn't tell, and then what are those other things, kind of the darker side of the history? Not just like, oh, the Vikings did this and that, but what actually happened?
What did you learn? How does it play out today for someone from new to the area, from Wyoming? I'm not sure that I've really experienced the Scandinavian-American intersection directly, but what lives on, Eric?
Yeah, you've probably experienced it a lot more than you realize. Like, there's one of the things that we learned over in Norway was this idea of Janteloven, which is the idea of these, of everyone has to sort of conform in a small town and you have to do it. So it was based on a book by this Danish Norwegian author. But it's this, ultimately it comes down to like, don't get too cocky. Don't think that you're so much better than anyone else. And don't try to brag. Don't try to show off. We see that with our style here. No one's like wearing fancy things. No one's wearing gold jewelry, all that kind of stuff. It's sort of frowned upon. So that's just one of the things that we have here. Another big thing that I realized was there's the Nonpartisan League out in North Dakota in the Midwest, and the Farmer Labor Party, which became the DFL here in Minnesota, that there was actually quite radical. I mean, it's not even that radical, really, but very sort of left-leaning, liberal, progressive politics brought by these Scandinavians here. And even though, you know, we consider, you know, North Dakota may be a mostly Republican state, but a lot of the things that the Nonpartisan League passed on, which was, by the way, a subpart of the Republican Party, it was the socialist wing of the Republican Party. And this is why, you know, you have the North Dakota State Bank, the North Dakota State Mill, that was kind of against all the Pillsbury's and all in Mill City of Minneapolis. So it was this progressive idea that we don't have those big factory farms in North Dakota. We don't have all of that sort of worker-owned co-ops. And so that's a very Scandinavian thing that was passed.
I'll retell the news that we had earlier in the week here on Main Street. The Bismarck Cinema 100 film series starts this week in Bismarck, but January 16th movie is Northern Lights, and it's produced by a gentleman named John Hansen, shot in the late 1970s, and it's about exactly that, the very beginnings of the NPL, and it's well done and uses local folks to tell that story. What's the biggest misconception that you've come across, Eric, when you talk about Scandinavian immigrants here in the Midwest?
I think one of them is there's sort of the stoicism and kind of boring history and such. And I realized for myself, you know, and I kind of grew up thinking that too, and then realizing that it really wasn't that way at all. My grandfather passed on this idea that the Norwegians, the Swedes, you know, it's just, we're just a little bit better. I mean, he would never come out and actually admit this, but that was sort of the idea that, you know, we're kind of good, clean living, and, you know, we do all of these things. And that's not the reputation they had. Because there's this idea, there's always a Snus Boulevard or Snus Avenue. So snus was synonymous with snuff, like, you know, Copenhagen, Skoll, those kinds of, you know, chewing tobacco or, you know, that you snort. And so they were kind of the wild laborers that came into town. So I have this great quote that James J. Hill said, who built most of the railroads around here. He said, give me Swedes, snuff, and whiskey, and I'll build a railroad through hell.
How do you balance humor and historical accuracy, Eric, when you're writing it? I guess the way to make the book readable and fun, but also historically accurate.
For me, they kind of go together. And sure, what was interesting, a Sons of Norway representative down in Iowa, he was very worried about this book when I first told him about it. And he said, this is very sensitive, as if like people are going to come after me with, you know, pitchforks and torches or something.
Let's hope not.
I mean, in essence, it's just telling it like what actually happened. And for me, the history kind of came alive. It was, I began this project thinking, okay, how am I going to do this? What am I going to find out there? And I had no idea. And I started plotting out, okay, like where are the Scandinavian towns? Where are the churches? Where are all of the graveyards and stuff? And that got real dull real quickly. Instead, this was the book that I wanted to read growing up about our background. So finding out, you know, all of like about Prohibition. And so all of the, especially the Norwegian women who came out and were just tired of all of their men essentially being drunk all the time. And so they would actually invade bars with axes and smash everything. So, I mean, it was kind of a wild time. And there, you know, Veblen out in Wisconsin, you know, he's a pretty wild philosopher, talked about conspicuous consumption and all of these, and conspicuous leisure. That's where those terms come from. So this idea that there were quite a few countercultural Scandinavians, even though they tried to fit in more or less, but at the same time, they questioned a lot of the things that...
We're enjoying our conversation with Eric Dregny. His book is Vikings in the Attic in Search of Nordic America. And he'll be reading from the book at 1 p.m. Friday at the Sons of Norway in the Troll Lounge. Eric, in your opinion, what Scandinavian traditions currently have the most enduring influence, I guess, on our culture here?
I mean, one of the most obvious that we see, of course, is the food. And we tend to, if you're not Scandinavian, a lot of people think, oh, Scandinavian food is all just boring and bland and white and just nothing. And then you go over to Scandinavia and you have some of the food, and you have like the salt licorice and the cod liver oil and the Bruno, Sietost, all the brown cheese, all this kind of very intense flavors here. And so that's sort of one of the lingering traditions. And one of the interesting things I found is that some of these traditions we've held onto here, and they have since lost over there. For example, the idea of egg coffee, that you mix an egg into the grounds, into your coffee pot to mix it all together, to hold the grounds together and have like a clear cup of coffee. They don't talk back.
Does that sound good to you, Eric? I don't know that sounds very good to me.
Yeah, you don't really taste the egg. I mean, this is how my grandmother always made her coffee. So, and, you know, at the Minnesota State Fair, they always have their egg coffee booth. So we still have this here, and especially in smaller towns, you'll get a lot of that.
It seems to me Scandinavian immigrants were successful in establishing cooperative movements. Why do you think that is?
I think they realized soon enough that they were going to lose all of their profits to all of the money-making capitalists, the center, like the business owners who were already here. So, for example, Minneapolis is known as the Mill City, and so you had your Pillsbury's and all everyone. And so they were making all sorts of money with all of this grain coming in. And then all the farmers, and especially the dairy farmers, realized, like, wait a minute, we're just giving up anything for these terrible profits. And so that's when they got this idea that, I mean, it began, you know, in England and Denmark and such, and they brought this idea. There's actually a bishop who went around the Midwest and gave his butter sermons, saying, do not give up your butter. Do not give up your cream. Let's come together. We need to establish these cooperative creameries, and that way we can share in the profits. So that idea took off. And so there's electric co-ops, there's creameries, there's food co-ops, all sorts of different kinds of co-ops. It was a way of doing business that you wouldn't have, you know, your robber barons and other people coming in and getting all of the profits. And so now in the upper Midwest, we have more co-ops than anywhere else in the country because of that. And it's also helped to sort of redistribute the wealth, or at least not give the wealth just to the very wealthy.
You talk about and write about the interplay between the Lutheran faith and the social values of Scandinavian American communities. Tell us more about that.
So the idea of religion with a lot of these new immigrants that came in, because a lot of them originally, the first Norwegian immigrants that came 200 years ago came over because they wanted to be free of the constraints of the Norwegian Lutheran Church, sort of the state church in Norway. And so when they came here, they would establish these churches. And then one of the things they would say is you could always tell a Norwegian town because there would be two churches, because they would always be fighting with each other. So one group would separate from the other. So sort of these, you know, Lutheran work ethic, the Protestant work ethic that they would establish here would sort of help establish these towns.
The challenges you talk about in tracing your own Scandinavian heritage, how did that impact your storytelling?
My dad and I took a trip over when I was about 16 over to Scandinavia. We visited relatives in Norway and Sweden. It was very interesting when we visited relatives in this tiny town of Larv outside of Göteborg in Sweden. And we sat down and they brought out the family ancestry book, you know, with all the family tree, and they're trying to fill in some things. And we noticed this one line to this relative that was all scratched out. I'm like, well, what's up with that? And they said, oh, we don't think we're related to him. But clearly he fit into the whole scheme there. But he was a thief that was jailed. And he actually was brought in front of a judge and he stole the judge's clothes on the way out of the courtroom. So, I mean, there's that idea of, like, looking back, okay, what do we want to have our history be, and what was it in reality? So we choose that, too.
Sure, sure. And I think that historians and writers kind of have that ethical dilemma, if you will, all the time when they're writing. Was it hard for you to research?
Yes.
Yeah.
Just because there's so much of it and trying to decide what to include and what not to. So what ultimately became Vikings in the Attic were the best of, sort of the most interesting snippets of all these different places. And so, I mean, it cannot be a complete view of all the Scandinavian immigration into the U.S. Because there have been books written like that. And, I mean, I think the problem is it just gets so lost in the details. So I try to keep it down like little sections about different aspects of the culture of Scandinavian experience here in the Midwest.
Give us a sense of the day-to-day life that you led when you were living in Norway back to the life you're now leading in the cities in Minnesota.
Yeah, so our day-to-day life in Norway. Okay, so when we were there, my wife was pregnant and then we had a baby. And so it was all very much focused around that. We were staying in this little apartment up on the third story, and we had a great view of a graveyard. Okay. And it was dark there. So now we're in the dark time, or what they call the Myrketiden, which is, it's pretty intense there. So we were in Trondheim, which is just a bit south of the Arctic Circle. But at that point, you know, we're in Minneapolis anyway, we're the 45th parallel, which is the same as Milan in Italy. So this is way north. Darkness pretty much all day. We would get a little bit of light from about, I don't know, 10 to 2, but we didn't see the sun. So that was brutal. I would take a Midwestern, even a Fargo winter over Trondheim any day just because of the darkness. But then another big issue ended up being food. Like, how do we afford the food? Because it was so expensive. So we had to learn how to cook the fish. You know, the fish was always pretty cheap, although we'd go down to the fish market, and then the fishmonger there was kind of a trickster. He would always, oh, try this. And one time he had me try whale, and I was not too excited about eating whale. You know, the Norwegians hunt whales. So all these different things. So it was always a different experience each day going into town. They would actually heat the sidewalks downtown Trondheim to get rid of the ice.
I like that.
But most of the people in town, they wouldn't shovel their walks. They don't shovel everything like we do here or salt things. So the ice is terrible because the temperature's not as cold, but it's kind of right around freezing a lot of times. And so because of that, we would be sliding all over the place with our little baby carriage. You would have to have what they call pigge, which are the spikes on the bottom of your shoes that you strap on. But then once you get downtown, you have to take those off because it's all heated sidewalks. Otherwise, you go into like a restaurant or a cafe or something, they have their welcome mats, and the crampons, the pigge, will actually stick to the welcome mats, clack around. So, anyway, that's all just a snippet of our day-to-day life in the winter anyway in Norway.
Were you able to experience summer? Was that a little more interesting for you and a little more relaxing?
Yeah, summer was amazing. So we arrived in July and it was daylight all the time. And people told us, oh, that's going to be awful. You're not going to be able to sleep. I loved it because it's not the intense sun that we get here in the summer. The sun does this big sort of circle over your head and it never got above 80, maybe 85 at the very hottest.
Sounds pleasant.
And in Trondheim, there were no mosquitoes. But no mosquitoes.
Like that too.
Yeah, so they could just have the windows open. You could sleep out on your port, on your deck if you wanted to. It's amazing. Loved it.
Eric, have you noticed any, I guess, regional differences in how Scandinavian culture is celebrated across the Midwest?
Yeah. You know, you go to different, you know, there can be Danish towns and Norwegian towns and Swedish towns, Finnish towns. I think it's maybe more the difference like going out east and seeing some of the Norwegian communities out there, and they tend to be much more connected still to modern Norway, whereas here in the Midwest, there's a real disconnect often between current Norway and what Norway was 100 or 150 years ago. So you go into towns, and like there's certain areas like around Starbuck and such in Minnesota, where in Benson, Minnesota, where they will still speak the old Norwegian dialects. And a lot of times these are dialects that have since changed back in Norway. So we have a touch of that history here that actually Norwegian scholars, linguists, have come here to study the dialects that are spoken in the Midwest.
Eric, what do you hope readers take away from your book, Vikings in the Attic?
I hope that they can have a different look of the Scandinavian culture that we have here, because we tend to just think of it as Lefse and Lutefisk and Vrimagrut, that there's quite a bit to it, especially in terms of the politics or sort of these progressive ideas and the co-ops and even sort of the anti-war movement and World War I. Also the idea of language that, you know, my grandfather told me. He's like, well, I always wanted him to teach me Norwegian, and he wouldn't do it. He refused to do it. And he said, we live in America now. We speak English. It's better that. And basically, he had lived through World War I and was afraid, because when he went to elementary school, that no one else there, I mean, the teacher said you had to speak English. And if you didn't speak English, you would get in trouble. But he couldn't speak English. And so he grew up with sort of this fear of Norwegian, of his old language. And so that idea of that it's actually good to be bilingual, it's good to speak these other languages, that we need to understand that. And then, in essence, we need to reflect on, okay, what are we doing now with new immigrants coming speaking Spanish, speaking whatever language. Like, we need to, even though it's frustrating if we can't understand these other languages, we need to do our part and try to understand them and not discourage them from speaking their own.
Eric, I've read one review that called your book a lively romp through Nordic America. Is that fair?
I hope so. Yeah, that seems pretty fair. Yeah.
If you were to write a follow-up to the book, what aspects, I guess, of Nordic America would you like to explore further?
That's a good question, because I tried to put everything into this one. So in terms of Nordic America, I mean, I might do one that's more just about the politics, but then, you know, politics, after a while, you get kind of, it gets sort of didactic, dogmatic. But I think that would be sort of an interesting one. And I think some people have done that, you know, writing about the cooperative commonwealth and some of these other ideas, but kind of reflecting back on what it means and what these immigrants brought to the country, and then what we can do now about it too, like to share the wealth and profit sharing and different sort of different corporate models, that we can still have a free market as they do in Scandinavia now, but have it more sort of fair so no one's out on the street.
My guest has been Eric Dregny. His book, Vikings in the Attic, is both a celebration and critique of Nordic American life. It provides a rich tapestry of stories, insights, revealing how Scandinavian immigrants and their descendants contributed to the cultural mosaic of America, and especially the Midwest. He'll be presenting his book and reading from it. Again, the book is Vikings in the Attic, In Search of Nordic America, tomorrow at 1 p.m. in the Troll Lounge at the Sons of Norway in Fargo. Eric, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Yeah, thanks for having me. See ya.
I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett.
And we are co-hosts of Away with Words. My background is in classical languages, and I never expected that I would be doing something every single day with ancient Greek, which is why I went into journalism. But this job combines both of those things in a really wonderful way.
I used to be a journalist as well, and an editor and an IT guy, but I've always had an interest in language, and I had an opportunity to join the American Dialect Society and eventually become an editor of dictionaries for Oxford University Press, where I specialized in new words and slang. So you bring Martha's classical stuff with my new novel stuff, and I think we kind of cover the gamut of what has happened and has happened in English.
I don't really think it's a challenge to make this topic interesting to people, because we all speak language, we all share stories, and people are a lot more curious about this than they realize. They might think initially, oh, this show isn't going to be interesting.
Yeah, they think it's two stuffy grammarians with corduroy jackets and patches on their elbows, but we're not cobwebby old school marks. Join us every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Mountain for Away with Words on member-supported Prairie Public.
This is Bird Note. How long can a bird fly without once touching the earth or alighting to perch? Experts have speculated for years that some kinds of swifts spend long, continuous periods of their lives in the air. To figure out exactly what they get up to, Swiss scientists began researching alpine swifts, a large species with a wingspan of over 2 feet. The research published in 2013 involved attaching sensors to some of the swifts while they were nesting in Europe and recovering them on the bird's return from spending winter in Africa. It was already known that the swifts eat on the wing, but what about sleep? The sensors showed long periods when the swifts were gliding and not flapping their wings. But scientists aren't sure if that means the birds were asleep. Could be that, like some other animals, alpine swifts do all their sleeping during the summer breeding season and don't sleep at all during migration. As for why they stay aloft so long, while they're supreme flyers, swifts find landing complicated. They can't perch because they have very short legs. So, if they can manage it, avoiding touching down makes perfect sense. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Pop
Coming up in the second half of Main Street, Matt Olean. He reviews movies with us here on Prairie Public each and every Thursday. And the movie he'll review today is The Brutalist. It's a long show, but Matt likes it. Also, Dave Thompson and I review this week's news, including the start of the North Dakota legislative session. That's all coming ahead on Main Street right after this.
There's the music we look forward to each and every Thursday. It's time for our weekly review of the news here in the state with our news director, Dave Thompson. Dave, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too, Craig.
I guess, Dave, there's really nothing much going on in your life now for the next
weeks. Of course not.
The North Dakota legislature is now in session. Let's start with the State of the State address by Governor Kelly Armstrong. Dave, What was your takeaway?
The property tax reform thing is very interesting. You know, he came out with what he's calling an achievable and durable property tax relief form. But now we're talking about some questions being raised about it. One of the things that's in it is a 3% cap. And local governments are saying, well, that doesn't give us a lot of room to maneuver. If, say, you have a fire truck that goes bad and you have to build a new fire truck, they're going for about $900,000 these days. So if you put that 3% cap on, smaller cities might say, we can't do this. This is the first step. So there will be a lot more steps before the final process and the final product is done. So we'll see what happens as it makes its way through the labyrinth, so to speak.
And I think that there are things in the bill that perhaps would allow a local entity to save money from year to year to year to make that larger planned purchase. But as you say, if it's an unplanned kind of an emergency, they might have to make some changes to legislation for that. Anything else in the State of the State address, Dave, that caught your ear?
He did talk a little bit about behavioral health and about how to reduce overcrowding in the state penitentiaries by working on behavioral health, because a lot of people who are now sent to the state penitentiary have addiction problems and have mental health problems. So he is talking about maybe doing something along those lines to keep people out of prison. This leads to what I think is going to be one of the more interesting building project stories that's going to happen, and that's about the new state hospital. Should there be a new state hospital or shouldn't there be?
Well, I think there's some discussion on whether the services should be dispersed throughout the state.
Correct.
Rather than centralized in Jamestown. What are people saying about that?
Well, they're saying that, the current state hospital in Jamestown has some buildings that are old and dilapidated, so it needs some work. The plan that came up in the interim that was bought off by legislators on the interim committee that studied it, and of course the Department of Health and Human Services, is $300 million for a new state hospital, and then having people be available at the state hospital to take care of these acute psychiatric needs. Well, Senator Mathern has come up with a bill. Let's take some of that money and let's go $100 million to establish these regional centers and have people who will heal closer to home, which is going to be, I think, a huge discussion in this upcoming legislature.
All right, Dave, before we move off the State of the State and this property tax question, you alluded to this a little bit earlier. One of the groups that's come with questions about it is the League of Cities, and their executive director has some concerns with the proposal. Tell me a little more about that.
He said the tax credits, talking about the expanding the homestead tax credit, thinks that's a great idea. But again, the 3%, that limits, some of the smaller cities about what they can do and what they can't do. And a preview, I'll have a story coming up later this week, of course, with the counties and their perspective on it. And they say the same thing. You can't have a Cass County versus a Slope County and keep each for 3%. 3% in Cass County may mean $1 million. 3% in Slope County might mean $25. So you have to work that through, yes. And I just heard something today that I'll pass along. There could be as many as 50 to 60 bills dealing with property taxes.
All right, Dave, let's move on. The former lieutenant governor has now been appointed as the interim Bismarck State College president. What do you know about that?
Well, I do know that the Board of Higher Education held a meeting today to talk about having an interim president. They chose Brent Sanford, and he was Doug Burgum's running mate in 16 and 20 and also was lieutenant governor until 2022. Now, starting date, he's going to start right away, from what I understand now. And this Dan Langang, who is BSC's Vice President of Academic Affairs, was named acting president after the sudden departure of former President Doug Jensen, who resigned because he said of health concerns and also some personal concerns. So he only served a few days, but my people are telling me that he did not want the interim president on a full-time basis, and Brent Sandford is going to take that. Now comes the negotiations for salary for that interim president.
We'll watch that story as it unfolds. There's stories out there relative to higher education here in the state specifically.
I think this is the first of a number of stories we're going to hear.
Dave, North Dakota lawmakers are considering a bill that will prevent abrupt ambulance service closures, something that should be concerning to us all.
It's very concerning, and you've had a couple of rural ambulance services who are basically staffed by volunteers have to close because they couldn't afford to do it anymore. So now the state is looking at what do we do in these situations to make sure ambulance services are covered. This is the first bite of the apple. We'll watch this bill as it goes through the session, but it's going to be very interesting.
Dave, the Standing Rock Tribal Chair talked a lot about law enforcement in her address to the legislature. What else did she have on the table for the legislators to consider?
Well, she did talk about law enforcement, of course, the missing and murdered Indigenous people, because she said that has become an epidemic. And the other thing that she's talking about is that there needs to be a special alert, like an Amber Alert, that will talk about missing and or murdered Indigenous people. So they're working on legislation on that. One thing I did find interesting, and this goes back a number of years because they've talked about it for a long time, is having a bridge built between Fort Yates and the western side of the Missouri River. Now she says we want to go ahead with it. They've got $14.5 million in a federal grant to help plan for the project. And she says there aren't that many crossings between Fort Yates and Bismarck. There's only a few there. And really, north, there isn't very many. There's Washburn, and that's about it. And she said this is a way to show, A, the state is unified, B, that we can get access to services on both sides of the river.
Dave, your colleague Katie David reported on the Whitestone Hill project that received a Difficult Topics Award. What was that story about?
Well, they thought it was just going to be a plain old battlefield with General Sully, but now they have determined that the 1863 battle was more of a massacre by Sully against Native Americans. So they are changing, you know, the look of the panels and the look of the explanations of what's happened at the Whitestone Hill battlefield, and that they've spent some money to do that and to, you know, bring more of a big focus on what actually happened there.
Dave, not only do we get to hear you on the radio, we get to see you during the legislative session on television.
Correct.
What's coming up in your legislative TV show?
Well, next week we start our legislative TV show, and the aforementioned governor has agreed to be my first guest. So we'll get a chance to talk to him about legislative priorities and what he's seeing so far in the legislative reaction to what he said in his State of the State address.
And Dave, you're also writing a newsletter. Bring us up to date on Do You Know DAC?
Do You Know DAC? We talked about, you know, the legislative session. There's going to be a lot of legislative stuff in it. This is meant to be a little bit more breezy and more informal. And one thing that I'm pursuing, and I'm going to let everybody know, you know, in Minnesota, there's a split house. It's split down the middle. And there was a legislative session that I covered that there was a split house as well. So I want to go back in the history of that and kind of tell the history of that too, because at the time we had 100 members of the house and it was split 50-50.
We drove through Minnesota yesterday, Dave, and that is a huge topic of conversation.
Yes, it
for
is.
Sure. A split legislature with no one having yet a clear advantage. Dave Thompson, he's our news director here at Prairie Public. We enjoy our conversations with him each and every Thursday. Dave, I hope the session goes well for you.
Thanks, Greg. I hope it does too. I'm thinking we're going to. It's going to.
Gather around, everybody. I'm gonna tell you a story.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
You're welcome.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
There's that walk-up music for Matt O'Lean's movie review, the first one of 2025. Matt, welcome back to Main Street. Happy New Year, bud.
Happy New Year, Greg.
This is the first review, of course, of the year, and the movie is called The Brutalist, and it follows the life of Laszlo Toth, a Jewish-Hungarian architect and Holocaust survivor who flees post-war Europe to seek a new beginning in America. Matt, what are your thoughts on how the Brutalist blends, I guess, historical reckoning with his personal journey? And do you think it successfully conveys the tension between art and commerce and immigration and all of those things?
I think this is certainly going to be, you know, Oscar nominations come out next Friday, the 17th. So this is certainly going to be right in there. It did very good at the Golden Globes. It's really long. It's 3 hours and 25 minutes, and it's maybe a little too long. I would say this is a film directed by Brady Corbett that swings for the fences. And what I mean by that, it swings for the artistic fences. It's trying to kind of be this, harken back to like 1970s auteur film director epics, or Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master, which was kind of about the L. Ron Hubbard story in 2012. It feels like that. It's shot on 70mm stock film, rarely seen these days. So it really looks good. It sounds good. The music score is great. I don't know if it quite achieves the true greatness I think that it was going for. I think there's really good parts in it, but I don't know if we're going to walk out saying this is the next Citizen Kane. It's certainly an ambitious movie. It's very artistic. There's a lot of themes here about anti-Semitism, which Toth experiences when he comes to Pennsylvania, first working for his cousin, and then he becomes this architect. And he is an architect in the movie, and that's the real key to the movie, is this chance meeting he has with Guy Pearce, who might win the supporting actor Oscar. Pearce plays this wealthy industrialist who kind of commissions Toth, played by Adrian Brody, to design buildings for him, you know, libraries, tributes to his mother, etc. And that is where the push-pull comes, as you know, Craig, between artistic freedom and what the man wants, what Guy Pearce wants. So Toth struggles with this. A lot of things. He struggles with a lot of things. His wife is not with him. Felicity Jones eventually shows up about halfway through the movie as his wife, who's stuck in Europe, and she gives a great performance. Supporting actress nomination is coming for her. Brody's magnificent. Certainly going to be right in there for best actor. I think for me, it was like missing a couple scenes. And I said it was maybe too long, but maybe some scenes could have been replaced. I just feel like it's a lot of good things. It's a really good movie, but something is missing to make it that true American immigration, American dream story, right? Godfather 2, I think, is the best American movie ever made about the immigrant story, right? The corruption of the American dream. This is kind of aiming for a Godfather 2 type commentary on the American dream and what he experiences in terms of, you know, his successes and his struggles and the failures. I just don't know if it quite gets there. And it's hard to put your finger on because it looks so good. It sounds good. The acting is great. But in the end, I'm kind of left with also, like, what kind of architecture was he doing? They really don't get into that too much. It's hard to put the artistic genius on film. We talked about this with Bradley Cooper as Maestro, as Leonard Bernstein, or Timothy Chalamet as Bob Dylan. Like, how did he write these songs? It's hard to put the creative process on screen. They do a pretty good job of it, but at the end, I'm kind of like, what was his building design? What kind of European architectural design was he bringing over there? There's a lot of personal issues he goes through. So I like this movie a lot, Craig. I just think it's not quite Godfather 2. It's not quite this epic immigration story that it's aiming for, but certainly great period design. Right after World War II, he comes to Pennsylvania. It's a movie that needs to be seen, and it's still really not in theaters around here. That's a really slow rollout for the Oscars, but I expect it will be soon available to people in this area to watch.
Matt, I should tell our listeners that we chose not to play the trailer for this movie today. It's really visually intense.
It is.
Musically intense. There's just not a lot of text that would offer much to our radio listener. But you talked about the visually rich style of the show. And what did you think of with the scene of the upside down Statue of Liberty? And how did those cinematic choices, I guess, enhance or detract from the film's theme and storytelling, Matt?
Well, the cinematography is one of the stars of the movie. It is shot on rarely seen 70mm stock. So it feels like you're watching kind of a Godfather, Lawrence of Arabia, something that has to do with 70mm, not digital, which is now, you know, all the rage. So it looks great. And that's why I think it feels like an art house film. This is a film for cinephiles, right? To go and study the cinematography and the production design and the actors. And I don't know if the general audiences are going to flock to this. I think the running time is going to keep people away. But I predict the cinematography and the score are going to win Oscars. That's really one of the stars of the movie. Adrian Brody would be vying for the 11th man ever to win the Best Actor Oscar multiple times. I still think Chalamet is going to win the Oscar. I think when the full Academy votes, which is much more than the Golden Globes, of course, and other critics' organizations, when the full measure of people in the industry vote, I do think Chalamet is going to beat Brody for Best Actor. It's going to be a really close vote, I think, but it's going to be amazing. This feels like there's a little bit of Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead in this movie, too. If you've ever read that book, Craig, or seen the movie with Gary Cooper.
I haven't.
That's about an architect who has visions, right? And he has to compromise, and he won't compromise. It feels like it's kind of a sequel to The Fountainhead a little bit, except with anti-Semitism thrown in, which he experiences. It's also, you know, it just feels like something like that. And I like that aspect to it. So,
Matt, given that the Brutalist is centered on these grand ideas like immigration, assimilation, and the promise of the American dream, did it leave you with that energy of the American dream and of our immigration ancestry?
Yes, I think it achieves that pretty well. As I said, I think it's one or two scenes short of becoming this masterpiece that I think Brady Corbett has designs on. He might win the directing Oscar. It's very possible that he will. We might have a split. Like I see Wicked maybe winning Best Picture and Corbett getting director. I can see that happening. But yes, this is, you know, a big part of this film is the immigration story. This Jewish architect escaping after the war, surviving the Holocaust, trying to get his wife over there. It does say a lot about the immigration story, the American dream, and the struggles to achieve the American dream. And there's one scene where he says, "They don't want us here," he says to his wife. "They don't," he means us Jews. "They don't want us here." And I think it's that old adage, too, where we see Guy Pearce will do business with a Jewish architect that he admires, okay? He'll do business with them, but he doesn't really want them there or like them. Do you know what I mean? There's part of that with the Guy Pearce character. Guy Pearce, Australian actor, he is amazing as the industrialist who kind of takes Laszlo under his wing. And it's a very tenuous relationship. You know, at first it's very like, "Oh, you're a great architect. I want you to do this for me." But there's always strings attached, right, Craig? There's strings attached. And the relationship really between Guy Pearce and Adrian Brody in this movie is fascinating to watch, kind of the yin and the yang and this gentle pull and push between the two of them, sometimes more not gentle. That's really interesting in the movie as well. So there's three great acting performances in this movie. The cinematography is amazing. The immigration story, I just don't know if it's Citizen Kane or Godfather 2, but it definitely swings for the fences.
Before we get to our Oscar trivia question, Matt, just a quick question about the intermission. Did the intermission fit here? Does it detract from the experience?
It's fine if you need to get up and go to the bathroom, if you're watching it on a screener or a digital or a streaming service. I think it's going to be in theaters really soon as we're talking here, but it's a slow rollout for people to see this. I saw it because I vote for the North Dakota Film Society and I got a screener. I'd rather see it on the big screen than on a laptop, and it needs to be seen on the big screen. I want to emphasize that. If you go, this is an epic movie that needs to be seen on the big screen.
All right, Matt, let's get to our Oscar trivia question of the day. You talked about Godfather 2. Another movie that this question is about is the musical adaptation that focuses on the struggles of Puerto Rican immigrants and their interactions with New York City's established communities. What movie am I talking about, and how many Academy Awards did it win?
So the 1961 version of West Side Story is what you're talking about, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, Best Picture, Best Director for Jerome Robbins and Robert Wise, Best Supporting Actor George Chakiris, Best Supporting Actress Rita Moreno. I'm guessing the cinematography got the Oscar. Music adaptation, probably, you know, from Leonard Bernstein and Stephen Sondheim. Art direction, it probably won. I'm guessing it won sound. Editing, costumes, is that about, am I up to 10?
10 in all, Matt. That's correct.
Second most ever. Three films.
One of the great movies that I've enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
Matt Olien joins us each and every Thursday as he reviews movies for us here on Prairie Public. Matt, thanks again.
You bet.
More Main Street's ahead. Stay with us.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Daybook for January 9th. Harrison A. Bronson was born in Nunica, Michigan, on November 19th, 1873. His Master of Arts degree was the first master's degree granted by the University of North Dakota. He earned his law degree from the University of Minnesota. In 1901, he opened a practice in East Grand Forks, Minnesota, but shortly after moved to Grand Forks, where he practiced until 1917. He served in the state Senate, followed by a stint as Assistant Attorney General. In 1918, he was elected to the Supreme Court. After 6 years, he retired and planned to return to Grand Forks. On this date in 1925, the Bismarck Tribune reported on his farewell to the city. Bronson was invited to a meeting at the Mackenzie Hotel. Upon arrival, he was escorted to the banquet hall, where he was greeted by many well-wishers. Several speakers, including Governor A.G. Sorley, senators, representatives, and the Chief Justice of the North Dakota Supreme Court, addressed the gathering. Bronson was deeply moved by the gesture. He gave a short speech, thanking his friends and reflecting on the 6 years he had spent in Bismarck. Bronson returned to private practice in Grand Forks and lectured at the University of North Dakota School of Law. He also wrote 4 books on property law. He had a deep fondness for the university, and his most generous but perhaps least known legacy was a gift of 160 acres to the school. What is now known as University Village was originally called the Bronson property. For decades, the property was used for sports fields and a community garden. In 1997, plans were made to develop the land. An ambitious plan was created that included university, commercial, and residential construction. The first building, a bookstore, opened in 2000. The Ralph Engelstad Arena, home to the UND ice hockey program, known as The Ralph, opened in 2001. Hockey star Wayne Gretzky called it one of the most beautiful buildings we have in North America. The Betty Engelstad Sioux Center, home to the Fighting Hawks basketball team, is located next to the arena. Other buildings on the site include a student wellness center, a family practice clinic, and apartments. Harrison Bronson passed away in 1947, but his legacy lives on in University Village. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that's it for today's edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Remember, you can reach out to us here at Main Street if you have an idea for a segment on our show. Email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. We would love to hear from you. Tomorrow in this time slot, at 3 p.m. Central, it's The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. His topic, what should happen now with Ukraine? At 7 p.m. Central, tomorrow, it's Science Friday with Ira Flato. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we hope you'll join us again next week, right here on Main Street.